Hello, welcome again to Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we're doing a very special episode. We're talking about some of our very lowered expectations with the finishing of season one of Star Trek Discovery. I know this is a little late, but better late than ever. It's, of course, I'm my co-host, J.D. from Saskatoon.
We're not going to live long and prosper.
Also, this is Red Ink.
Steve kills Dumbledore.
So, yes, let's talk about Star Trek Discovery. I think it's pretty much universally accepted by anyone who even had a passing, like, fancy for any old Trek that this, by far, was, I think the word used is, like, blasphemous to anything even remotely old Trek. Because people were like, there was initial old Trekkie reaction to the Abrams stuff. And I think this is sort of the case where you can go to them and say, no, it got worse.
Yeah, I don't know if I would use blasphemous, but it's, I want to say uninspired and full of shock value for shock value's sake. Like, you know, we talked about this in a previous episode, you know, we're comparing Discovery to, you know, the Orville, and at the time I came out, it's like, I want to see the end of the season before I make a judgment. I'm going to make my judgment now. It's not that good. I mean, you know, there is a heavy amount of SJW smeared all over this thing. You know, whether you got Sonequa Martin-Green, who plays the main character, Michael Burnham.
Her name is Michael, not Michelle, Michael.
Michael. And that's cool. I mean, it's not unheard of. There was can I finish before you start groaning?
Yes, you can finish.
There was an actress, I forget if it was on Law and Order or I think it was Homicide: Life on the Street. There was an actress, her name was Michael Michelle. She was the love interest of he was the guy that starred in like all the sequels to The Substitute. You know, in that first movie where B.D. Wong was the villain, you know, so it's not unheard of to have a woman have a man's name like that. It's cool. It's just, I just don't see, it didn't make her special. I think it's just, again, that's a shock value for shock value's sake thing. I will say some of the turns they did, I thought were interesting. I mean, I don't necessarily think it worked, but felt they were interesting. You know, you had the reveal, and yeah, spoiler warning, by the way, folks. And if we really got to remember to say that from the top next time. But you and I had kind of argued a bit, Ben, about the character of Tyler, like, and you called it. It was Valk. You know, he was, you know, what do you call it, Manchurian candidated into Ash Tyler. I remember I was saying he was definitely a traitor or a mole of some type. I didn't think it was actually going to turn out to be
the albino.
Albino with plastic surgery.
I think pretty much everyone, like, I'm not going to say everyone out of everyone called it because obviously you didn't, but most of the internet saw that coming. I'm serious. And I think the problem was if the producers had the money, they would have done something about it and refilmed shit. But because so much of the season was already in the bag, they couldn't do that. And I think they were really pissed off the fans figured out that, well, I won't say fans, I think most people hate watch this, honestly. If I had to be honest, I think the majority of their numbers was hate watching. But again, I think that the problem was that there are certain things they did redo and did do differently because of the initial reaction from viewers. Because, well, first off, the first half of the season was done without any action or reaction or even input from anyone who had any Trek experience. It was halfway through season one until they brought in people like Nicholas Meyer and people who actually had Trek experience into the show. And by then, the damage was done, and it was too late. They were already going in a certain direction, and the saddest thing about this is the show is a very badly done political allegory, and I think we'll let Red take it from here. Red?
Badly done political allegory is what you want to talk about?
Yes, yes.
Well, it's obvious that they're trying to make it, a soapbox about Trump, because you have the albino guy who takes the throne of fucking, of Kronos, or not the Kronos, but that weird clan that they made up for the series. And they show this Klingon, who is the first leader, that he was, well, he's a black Klingon for one thing. He was the Klingon that everybody was bitching about, how all the Klingons are too dark and don't look nothing like regular Klingons anymore. And they showed his past, and he's like playing soccer and shit. It's like, okay, I guess he's Obama. So he takes over and he fails. And that's what everybody thought would happen with Trump. And then you have at the very end, once again, fucking spoiler, Hillary wins. The female Klingon is the one who takes over all, not just that clan, but all of Klingon society, because she has a bomb that'll blow up Kronos.
The ultimate pipe bomb, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That was honestly, and you know, nothing really turned me against the show until that was the end. Like, and you know, fans, I've seen the arguments online. Well, you know, that goes completely against Starfleet's morals, and but they're in, it's a war, and they're trying to win. It's like, there had to have been another way. You know, and the whole ideas of, you know, they build up Valk as being like this chosen one. He's, you know, he's on this epic quest. Like, you kind of get that in the first few episodes, that he's going to be on this epic quest to unite, like, what did they say, like the 18 houses of the Klingon society. Because there was, you know, the Obama Klingon that, you know, brought Valk in because, you know, he was being completely shunned by their society because he's an albino, and he brings him in and makes him the torchbearer. And then, you know, Obama Klingon is killed by Michael, and then starts this war, the War of the Binary, or Battle of the Binary Stars, and it starts this war between the Starfleet and the Klingon Empire. And I mean, I wish we could have seen more of that, but it's the main thrust of the show is like Michael's journey, because she instigated this, and she betrayed her captain, played by Michelle Yeoh, who I still have an ungodly crush on, because that woman just gets finer with age. And, you know, she dies in, like, the second part of the first two episode opener, and then they bring her back, where, of course, they're going to bring in the Mirror Universe, because name me one Star Trek series that hasn't used the goddamn Mirror Universe. I mean, I'm surprised they used it in the first season.
I think that shows a level of desperation here, because honestly, the biggest, other than the problem of the tone of the show, is also the fact that there's a definite betrayal of the concept of Starfleet here, and I think that what everyone was expecting when they saw the news about this show was they wanted something like Enterprise but good. I mean, honestly, I know that sounds horrible, but that's exactly what everyone was wanting from a prequel series, was like Enterprise, but good, was the fans' expectation. But instead, they did something that was, well, soap opery, preachy, dark, gritty, you know, with an inconsistent tone that went everywhere. Basically, they had something that pleased no one, didn't bring anyone new to Trek. Didn't please the old Trekkies. And I think the biggest problem is whenever you write for SJWs, yeah, you get good press, but you don't get good readers. Because, you know, anytime, just like in comics, whenever someone does something as a move to bring inclusiveness to comics, oh, look, inclusive, I have this blah, blah, blah character. No one reads that book. With Discovery.
Can't say that nobody... Here's the thing when it comes to SJW books, is they're always badly written. If you could make a good SJW book, you could make a good storyline featuring all the things that SJW loves, as long as you make a good fucking story. But they always fall on their fucking asses because they got too much shit that they want to get out there. Too much preaching to do. Whereas they should take their time. A good example of a popular show that was written by SJWs and it's for SJWs is Steven Universe. Now, I don't like that show. I don't watch that show. But I respect what it is. It's a show made for them by them. And it's an okay show from what I hear. And the fan base is really bad.
Well, it's good and bad. You know, I'm like a level one fan of Steven Universe myself. Like, I like what they've done in the show. You know, I enjoy that sort of thing. It's nice to have on the surface, a simple, entertaining cartoon that has, you know, a lot of deeper meaning to a lot of the stuff that goes on in it. But then there are the other people on the other end of the spectrum who, you know, if you don't love the show unequivocally and think it's the best thing ever, then, well, you just don't get it. You know, that sort of mentality. I mean, the SJW stuff in the show wasn't bad. I mean, a good example of something they did good in this series, you know, there's a lot of bad, but there's also a lot of good. I like the characters of, like, was it Lieutenant Stamets? And, you know, he's in a, you know, a gay relationship with the ship's doctor.
He was also in a gay relationship with Kevin Spacey.
Thank you, Ben.
A non-consenting gay experience.
Can I continue?
That's what Kevin Spacey asked.
How did I know you were going to bring that up? Anyway, yes, the actor Anthony Rapp has brought charges against Kevin Spacey, but his character of Lieutenant Stamets is this guy. He's created this new system of, I don't even think you can call it fat. It's basically like a super advanced version of teleportation using space fungus. Just one second.
Okay.
Let me finish. And besides all the ways that none of that science really makes sense to me, and I mean, I kind of understand it, but it still just doesn't make sense. I like how they introduced, you know, it's literally you get a couple of episodes, you see him and the doctor, you really have no idea they're together. And then you just have that night where they're sitting there, they're brushing their teeth before bed. And it's like, oh, they're a couple. That's cool. You know, they didn't shove it down their throats. They just kind of slipped it in under the door. And it's like, hey, that's awesome. That's cool. Let's see where it goes with this, which is why I was really, I wouldn't say sad, but I was kind of bummed out where, you know, it's revealed that Tyler is really Valk and his programming kind of slips and he snaps the doctor's neck. It's like, come on, I like that. And, you know, Stamets is kind of sitting there because he's been fucked up in this mycelial network transportation, you know, that all that science. And he's just kind of sitting, he has no idea what's going on because his mind has literally been stretched across, you know, multiple dimensions, because apparently space fungus is the gateway to the mirror universe.
All right, may I speak now?
Oh yeah, no, go ahead.
So let's talk about the Spore Drive, which, by the way, as Red pointed out long ago, was ripped off from Dune. And the concept of it was based off of this idea that there's spores everywhere in the universe. There's wherever you go, there's going to be spores. And based off this idea is there's this kind of a bug called a water bear. And water bears can live through almost anything. They can live through like high pressure, low pressure, no oxygen, low oxygen, heat, cold, etc., poison. You can't kill a water bear. So there's this concept of the water bear. So now they have like a water bear.
You can kill.
Yes, you can, but I'm just saying what the concept is of the water bear, the pseudoscience concept. But Red is right, you can absolutely kill a water bear. But basically, the concept that they were going with Discovery was the water bear also lives in bacteria, or in fungus. So, basically, the water bear, by definition, is the perfect navigator for the spore drive. So they have this giant ass water bear that they clamp the spore drive to its nipples. And, you know, just like Kevin Spacey. And then they...
What? You ruined the joke.
Okay.
You should have said Mel Gibson.
Okay. But the point remains is that's what it looks like, is the spore drive is clamped to the water bear's nipples. And because the water bear is connected to the spore drive, it can teleport the Discovery anywhere, and it's... pizza cutter saucer section like flips sideways when it does. It looks really fucking stupid. And the problem with this sort of FTL drive, the spore drive, is basically once the Discovery has it working, you basically run out of most drama in a series because in Star Trek, you know, some of the best episodes of Star Trek are those going against the clock episodes where basically a ship like the Enterprise is heading towards a destination. They have to get there on time, and it's and the clock is tight. But the spore drive, oh, the Discovery can go anywhere. Boom. Mushrooms. And it's stupid. Well, go ahead, Red.
There's also how in classic Trek, like 50% of the episodes are the fucking engine doesn't work.
Yes.
We're stranded. What the fuck are we going to do?
Yes.
Somebody get the Scotsman off the Scotch, you know, get the miracle worker to work. Now, from what little I understand of, because I used to read the tech manuals way back in the day for like Next Gen and that, like the concept, like to get some, you get the energy field around the ship going, and that is the warp bubble around the ship, and that is part of how they get the warp to travel faster than light.
You also hook it to a mouse on a wheel.
Yeah, that too. Well, then that's the backup in case, you know, the dilithium crystals aren't crystallizing. But I just, like, there was that episode where they broke the spore drive and ended up in the mirror universe where they did, like, 137 of these spore jumps in an effort to somehow that gave them telemetry that allowed them to break through the cloaking technology of the Klingons. Okay, sure, but that's only really going to work the once, because by the time they get that to the rest of the fleet, the Klingons, if they've got cloaking technology, they got to have people working on this. The humans have broken our cloak. Well, here's version 3.5, and then you have to do that all over again. Like, just the logic of that move made no sense. And
well, the cloak doesn't make sense either, because actually it contradicts existing canon, and the whole big thing that they were pushing when they were making the show, and even after the show came out, is this show is in canon with the adventures of Jim Kirk and TOS, is what everyone pushed. Is they're like, don't worry, it's going to be in canon. And the cloak existing in itself breaks that canon, because the first time you see a cloak is in the TOS episode Balance of Terror.
Before is then, it established in that episode that was the first time the Klingons used the cloak?
No, it was actually the Romulans. The first time the Klingons used the cloak was in a later episode where they had the brief Romulan-Klingon... what's it called? Romulan-Klingon alliance, where they traded the cloaking device with the Romulans, and the Romulans in turn got D8 cruisers from the Klingons.
Okay. Well, but see, here's the thing. Like, again, that's one of the things that bothered me the most about this series is their statement that this is original timeline, you know, Trek. That this is 10 years before Kirk's Bones and Spock, and like 100 years after Captain Archer and the NX-01. But the Klingons, like, and I've read some of the Expanded Universe books. To my knowledge, the Klingons, we have two versions of the Klingons that have always existed in this timeline. There's the football heads, and there's the Mongolian-looking Klingons that we got in TOS, which were the result of the genetic disease that Dr. Soong created. Sorry?
I thought you were saying the cure that Dr. Phlox made.
No, as the Was that a cure that created that, or was it the disease that Dr. Soon created?
Dr. My Soon point is... made it never made a disease. Dr. Soon made augmented humans. The Klingons took the augmented human DNA and experimented with it. One of the Klingons that had the augmented DNA happened to have like the Klingon version of measles, which mutated into a disease that was deadly. Dr. Phlox was able to make an immunization which basically spread the appearance of humans as a disease, but also immunized the Klingons.
Okay, let's see. I haven't watched Enterprise in forever. I more or less like that series. I mean, the biggest problem I ever had with that was the last episode. But what
Enterprise
I'm saying
had then, Enterprise had issues. I mean, if we're gonna take a quick segue in Enterprise. Enterprise's biggest issue was it took 3 seasons for them to basically fire Brendan Braga and bring in a showrunner that was competent, Manny Coto. Manny Coto was against the wall, inherited a show that was already near cancellation, but damn did he fight hard. It was a losing battle, but damn did he fight hard to try to save the show. And again, he inherited a mess, and there's only so much you can do if you walk into a mess, you know?
Yeah. So what I'm getting at with the Klingons is these are clearly space orcs, and somehow J.R.R. Tolkien was a prophet of the future. No, what I'm saying is this has got to be the Kelvin timeline. This is the Abrams verse, because you look at the designs of these costumes, and it's very reminiscent of the design aesthetic they used for the Klingons in Star Trek Into Darkness. Like,
there's a reason for that.
Okay, is there a good reason why Klingons are strapping their dead to the outside of their ship? Because I've never heard of that happening before.
That's actually not a Klingon thing to do. That's, again, against continuity. Because basically, when a Klingon dies, what they do is they hold the dead the corpse's eyes open, and they scream. What they're doing when they do that is they're alerting the underworld that Klingon warrior is coming. And then they look at the dead body and say, it's just an empty shell now. You know, you can do with it as you please. It means nothing to me now. Klingons don't have burial rights. And, again, I challenge you to go into past Trek. I promise you this has been consistent. They've actually been scarily consistent with Klingon burial rights. And so the idea of them, like, doing special preparations with dead bodies is absurd. It's absolutely absurd. I mean, Red, what are your thoughts on this?
I just remember an episode of Worf where they're discussing what's going to happen with his body when he dies, and he said, just fucking throw me out into space. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Once I'm gone, I'm gone. This body isn't me anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, one thing that I absolutely loved in this series is the use of one Harcourt Fenton Mudd, played to perfection by Rainn Wilson, especially in the 7th episode, Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, which is a time loop episode. I know it's hack, but it worked in this episode. Because Rainn Wilson, given the right character, can be incredibly magnetic and charismatic with his performance. And I absolutely loved his version of Harry Mudd here. That being said, what a character I thought was going to be my favorite overall and ended up just kind of being cool was Captain Gabriel Lorca, played by Jason Isaacs, who I was prepared... I knew we were going to get to this episode eventually, and I was prepared to fight for the honor of the man that I dubbed the baddest motherfucker in the Star Wars universe. And then it turns out he's just the evil duplicate from the mirror universe, and that's why he's such a badass in battle. And I felt betrayed.
The funny thing is I called that with you guys.
You were right. I think the problem
is that. I just pulled it out of my fucking ass. Like, I said it sarcastically. Like, this guy doesn't fucking follow any of the Federation rules. What if he's a fucking mirror universe spy or some shit?
And you're right. You were right.
Yeah, you
are.
I mean,
but I think the biggest problem I have, you know, looking at that is the fact that I think that when you look at Lorca, they had a chance to do something amazing. Like when Deep Space Nine did the Dominion War, Sisko had to go to the edges of morality to do what would need to be done to shorten the war, to save lives. And they could have pushed something similar with Lorca. Like, here's a man that's willing to bend to save the Federation. But no, he's just from the mirror universe. He's just an evil guy. And I feel like, again, that's a missed opportunity. They had a chance to do something amazing, but they copped out. And I think the whole last part of Discovery was something that you could easily call the cop out. And, you know, looking at things like Lorca and even things like what they did with the mirror universe. I mean, when they did the mirror in the TOS for the first time, there was a great line by Spock at the end, like where Spock talks to Kirk and says that a civilized man can pretend to be a savage, but a savage can never pretend to be a civilized man, because basically when the mirror universe versions of Kirk, you know, came to the Enterprise, Spock was instantly able to figure it out and held them in confinement, like, because he figured it out in 2 seconds, while Kirk on the mirror universe Enterprise was able to pose as a savage and was able to, like, hold a masquerade for quite a while before mirror Spock figured it out.
Yeah.
And I think that Lorca, I understand what he was supposed to be. I understand he was supposed to be more charming, more intuitive. But at the same time, you know, this is a man that fooled everyone, to the Admiral who was the real Lorca's former lover, to everyone who ever knew Lorca. He was able to fool all of them. And as for Harry Mudd, let's talk about Harry Mudd, because I feel like if you've ever seen the original TOS episodes with Mudd, Mudd is a con man. Mudd is the slimy car salesman. He's an anachronism of an older time. He is trying to get a quick buck and get out of there. Harry Mudd is not the kind of guy that would do anything so heinous as to have a criminal record that would, like, land them in, like, Klingon jail, or do something so crazy as to do a repeating time loop where he repeatedly kills the Discovery crew over and over again. I feel like they thought Mudd equals scoundrel, scoundrel equals bad guy of the episode. And I think, and the fact that they like, reunited him with his wife as a way to turn him, you know, turn him off his vengeance was really fucking stupid, especially since, if you ever seen the episode, you know, where Mudd has the planet of androids, you would know Mudd fucking hates his wife. Like, Kirk, as a way to torture Mudd for all eternity, had Mudd stuck on a planet full of nothing but, like, 500 androids of his wife screaming at him.
Which is why it was such a perfect torture to send him off with his wife at the end of that episode. Like, did you see the look of hatred in his eyes when Lorca sent him off? I was like, oh no, have a good life. And he's just like, fuck you. Like, he's a quick buck. He'll do whatever it takes to get the money done. Just because you think he wouldn't take advantage of such he wouldn't take advantage of time travel like that? Like, tell me a con man wouldn't love the idea of going back over and over and over again to get what he wants. You know, and like I said, it none of the performances were perfect. I just loved Rainn Wilson's take on it. Just the dialogue and the interaction they had with Burnham and Stamets in that time loop episode was great. But to go back to Lorca for me, like, everything that after it's revealed that he's the mirror universe, even if they didn't do that, you look at the stuff before, like, you know, he claimed that his eyes, you know, because he can only take, like, low light because his eyes were damaged, where he sacrificed his crew and, you know, he was the only one that lived. And you think he's just like this huge coward. Now he's trying to act like the ultimate badass to keep anyone from getting close, and sleeping with a gun under his pillow. I mean, that could have just been PTSD. I mean, everything that was a clue that he was somebody else could have also been taken the other way. And I kind of like what they did with Lorca in that. And then you, when we actually get to the Mirror Universe, it's, dear God, why?
I think the biggest problem with the Mirror Universe was they didn't know how to play it. There was definitely some attempts at humor, especially after the mid-season break. There was some attempts at humor. I feel like some of these were reshoots that were done after the reaction to the first half of the season. Because there was a definite attempt to interject more humor into this series after the mid-season break. And I feel like a lot of it's clumsy. Very clumsy. I feel like, at the same time, looking at it, that the Mirror Universe, you know, the Dark Universe literally is dark, so dark that humans have like, sensitive to light, eyesight, and I think that was stupid. I think that was a cop-out. I feel like the scene where Michael figures out Lorca is a Mirror Universe Lorca, if they left out the whole eyesight thing, because everything else was just with dialogue, I felt like if they did that, and like refined it a little bit better, because they had an inkling of a good idea there.
Yeah. Now I want to ask you, Rhett, what did you think of that scene in the finale or towards the end, like where they had the second part of the Mirror Universe episode where, you know, Michael deduces, it's like, wait, your eyes are sensitive to light. Did that make your blood boil, or did you just want to tear your hair out?
It was literally me doing the Picard fucking
face palm,
yeah.
Okay. Now, another character they had in this thing, multiple episodes, was Sarek, Spock's father, who is the adoptive father of Michael Burnham. Her parents were killed by Klingons. She is a human raised in Vulcan culture. You know, what did you think of James Frain's performance as Sarek? Me, myself, I thought he did really well. Because the guy is practically a Vulcan in real life.
It wasn't terrible, but at the same time, I wouldn't say really well either. I feel like this is, you know, I have more story problems with the idea of Michael Burnham being Spock's secret sister. Because, let's be frank here, this is pure Mary Sue territory already, where we have, oh, she's Spock's secret sister. Oh, she's a human, but she was trained to be like a Vulcan, so she has Vulcan abilities, even though she's human. I mean, this is like some of the stupidest Mary Sue shit I've ever seen. It reminds me of like all these ideas of like, well, a human can go Super Saiyan if we da 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 like that.
See,
go ahead, Red.
One of the things that where they shit the bed with Michael Burnham was that she was taught to act like a Vulcan and use logic, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They eventually abandon that, and they don't give any reason to why they abandon that, but suddenly she has emotions and all that shit mid-season. They just forgot. I forgot she was Vulcan. They had an interesting story idea where she could have fought between being a human and being a Vulcan, and making a choice, just like Spock did.
And that's sorry, Fred. You go.
Whereas she chooses to be human, where her brother Spock chooses to be Vulcan, kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's another thing that really kind of bothered me. Like again, I ultimately it's just okay. I like the season. It's okay, but that's something that bothered me because you get those first few episodes where she's human but she's Vulcan, therefore she's kind of a bitch. And that was kind of interesting just in the context of, you know, how would a human raised as a Vulcan and after being forced back, you know, everything that happened with being stripped of her rank and thrown in prison, like, you know, how would this affect her? And like two or three episodes before the mid-season finale where they get thrown into the Mirror Universe, she gets the D. She falls in love with Ash Tyler, who, after being rescued from a Klingon prison, and clearly the dude's got PTSD, Lorca, although now it's probably some Machiavellian plot point of the Mirror Universe Lorca's plan, is made security chief of the Discovery. Sure, whatever, it's Star Trek, I'll deal with it. As soon as she gets the D from the undercover Klingon, all of a sudden, all the Vulcan in her system has been purged, and she's got emotions again, and my God, why?
There's lots of reasons why, but let's touch on that some more, the whole
idea.
Was
the sex that good?
I mean, honestly, there's lots of problems that they have with the idea of Michael Burnham's character. My biggest problem is just the way they structured the show. Because, honestly, you could have taken the first half of the season, and if you restructured the episodes with the footage that they had, you might have had a much better series. Because remember, what were we told about Michael when we first saw Michael? Oh, she's great. She's fantastic. She's a great commander. She's a rising star in Starfleet. She's so skilled. She's everything. And then we watch her do the screw-up, and people still talk about how great she was, but she did the screw-up. And I think if you restructured the show and restructured the episodes where if you start the show and she's already on the prison ship, she's already being transferred, she's already on the prison ship, she's already made the mistake. And people talk about how she was great, but she's disgraced now. But you don't show the disgrace yet. You have the viewer watch her at that point, and then like through flashbacks and maybe even a flashback episode later on, you show what the mistake is, you might have structured something far better than what you did, is what I think. Again, I'm not a film editor, I'm not a director, but that's what I think would have worked better.
All right. So I want to ask you, Red, is there any of the characters in the main cast that you... Which one did you love the most, and which one did you wish died in a garbage fire?
I wish they all died in a garbage fire. They're all irredeemable.
Even Tilly?
Even Tilly.
Blasphemy. Tilly was like the one thing I was like, man, I hope she doesn't die, because Tilly's like the cute little puppy dog of the Star Trek universe, you know. Especially in that first the first scene with her and Michael where they become roomies and she's like, wow, the only other Michael in Starfleet is like, oh my God, you're her. You know, I just like seeing a character like that in this sea of assholes. There is this one bright shining spot of humanity who's just trying to do it for the right reasons and, you know, all that. And
one of the things that bugged me about Tilly the most is they have that episode where Michael Burnham is trying to shape her up so she can be a captain one day. And she can't even run a fucking lap. How the fuck did she make it into this academy?
I'd make a suggestion, but it would be really rude towards women. Now, the other character, I kind of liked him only because I liked the performance of the actor, and that is Saru, played by Doug Jones. We know and love him as Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies.
His performance was good, but I don't think it's anything noteworthy. I mean, we're talking about characters who, you know, looked over that moral event horizon and like, okay, and just jumped in. I feel like there's nothing really that great. I feel like we're talking about a whole season of where, if you ask me, they took the tone of Ronald Moore's Battlestar Galactica and tried to replicate it in a Star Trek universe, and it just doesn't work.
It wasn't just that. They also used Mass Effect as a...
Yes, you're right.
...design point. Like, Saru, going back to him. All the alien characters in Mass Effect are based off of actual animals and insects that exist in our fucking world, but humanized. I realized what Saru was. He's a giant fucking shrimp. That's why he's delicious in Chinese food.
Yes, and speaking of Chinese food...
Mirror Universe Michelle Yeoh probably looked at him and started thinking up a recipe.
Drunken shrimp?
Well, I mean, he's not even a shrimp. He's a giant walking mass of kelp. His species are called kelpians. He's walking seaweed. But, I mean, I like the idea they created this original alien race that they basically have super evolved spidey sense. They sense the oncoming of death. I thought that was a cool idea applied in the Star Trek universe. I could almost see there being a species like that. I thought that was a cool thing. And like I said, Doug Jones, I like his performance because Saru is a snippy little bitch. And eventually he warms up, you know, because initially when we come into the series after Burnham's been in prison, you know, he's treating her like she's got the goddamn plague. And rightly so, because, you know, she was responsible for the death of his captain. You know, he's also kind of jealous of her because he was going to be the number one before Michael came around. And he's kind of jealous of that. But I mean, by the end of it, they got to the point where him and Burnham were like, they're cool and they can work together. And I mean, eventually stuff like that came around. But yeah, I mean, it's nothing's perfect. I mean, I just enjoyed that in the series to have a character like that. And it's a clear attempt by the producers to make a fan favorite character along the lines of like Spock or Data. Like, you need that one alien character people to latch on to.
If I may, I have a problem with it because of the fact that you have a... I feel like anytime they make a new Star Trek series, they always try to introduce a new alien. And this is supposed to be a prequel series. I mean, this is 10 years before Kirk. And do you know who the five founding species of the Federation are?
Humans, Vulcans, Andorians, and I can't remember the other two.
Rigelians and Tellarites. I feel like instead of like introducing a new alien species, we could see like Andorian crew members and maybe a Tellarite, like a Tellarite second in command would have been an awesome idea, or a Rigelian.
What are the Tellarites? What do they look like?
They look like pig people, and they love arguing.
I remember them now. What do the Rigelians look like again?
Rigelians look, it's hard to describe. They have face piercings. They look like, they look like, space Native Americans.
Okay. And they have hooker planets?
Rigelians? No, you're thinking of fucking,
Risa?
Yeah. Risa is not the...
Also known as Riker's Stalking Grounds. Wow, I didn't think it was going to kill the mood like that.
But, so that's what that chick... On Star Trek Beyond, she was a Rigelian. That's what she is.
So, like I said, I would like to see Rigelians. I'd like to see Tellarites. Especially if we're talking about the, you know, couple, a show that's within the first 100 years of the founding of the Federation, we should be seeing more of the core five founding worlds on starships.
You know, even if we didn't see the other core races, I mean, you look at, why did we only stick to, you know, Saru, Michael, Tilly, Lorca, and Ash, and Stamets? I mean, that's seven, but you had all the other ones. You got, like, the communications officer. You know, I was going to put money down that he was related to Uhura. You know, you got the redheaded chick with, like, the cybernetic piece, like, stuck in her dome. You have the black chick with, like, the braids, who was, like, one of the navigators. You know, why didn't we get to know any of them? You know, why? I'm not saying they need to have full-on character episodes, but we don't even know their names. I mean, there's even that one cybernetic female or officer who kind of looks like Nebula from Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, I don't recall them ever getting their names. We heard like Lieutenant this or, you know, Ensign that, but I mean, we have no idea where half of the bridge crew is. I mean, we knew who most of the bridge crew was in like Next Gen and TOS, so why not?
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, now, you know, we're pretty much done here. I want to ask you honestly, Ben, is there not one single thing in this first season of Discovery that you enjoyed?
No, there was not a single thing I enjoyed.
You can't like anything, can you?
That's a horrible straw man to use. I mean, you can't say, oh, let's talk about something horrible. Oh, why don't you like something that's horrible? Oh, my God. You don't like anything. That's a horrible straw man to use. I mean, we're talking about
something that's horrible. It's not a straw man. It's a solid question. We're talking about
something that's horrible, and you're asking, why don't you like something that's horrible? That's like here, Ben, here's a big plate of shit. Well, you don't like eating shit? Well, you hate everything.
That's not what I'm saying at all. I mean, it's not like you have to love an entire episode or a character. I mean, there isn't like a concept or a little nod to something or a line of dialogue. You're telling me absolutely 100% there is absolutely not one thing you enjoyed that made you smirk like, okay, that was kind of cool in this entire season.
No.
You're a liar.
I'm not a liar. In fact, I got so pissed off when they played the TOS theme when they said it's the Enterprise and they showed the NCC-1701 at the end of the final episode, and they closed the final credits with a TOS end credits song, and that pissed me off because they did not earn it. They did not earn it.
No, they most certainly did not.
So yes, there was nothing I enjoyed in Discovery. Red.
My nipples, they hurt when you twist them.
Yes.
That made me laugh.
Okay, I did laugh at that scene, but for the wrong reasons. I was laughing more at the stupidity of the CGI guys doing that and no one saying, hey, yeah, this looks a little wrong. Let's fix this.
See, there's stuff you liked.
So, final thoughts, Discovery. They're doing a season two. I think it's going to be horrible. I think they're not going to learn any of the lessons they should have learned in season one. Red?
Season two only exists to promote that fucking CBS online access bullshit.
Which doesn't even matter anyhow, because you and I can watch it on the Space Channel here in Canada. So we don't have to buy into that bullshit at all. Me, myself, like I said, there is a bunch of stuff I like. There is more that I dislike. If you're a hardcore Star Trekkie fan and you want to see this, I say give it the 3 or 4 episode rule. If you still feel like you want to finish the season after that, go hard. But I wouldn't recommend this show to anything other than not a hardcore fan, but a true Star Trek fan. Because a casual sci-fi fan probably going to look at like the first two episodes and just, you know, peace out. You know, I liked stuff. I hated stuff. Unless we decide to look at season two after it's done, I'm probably not going to watch the second season. Cause like Ben said, you know, they may have been allowed to use it's the Enterprise and setting up this cliffhanger for the second season. I'm cool with that, but they by no means earned the right to use the closing credit music of TOS. You use your own damn music until you actually have characters on screen from the Enterprise. You don't touch shit from that series.
To me, it's more that they betrayed so much of the concept of the original Trek, what made the original Trek work so good, and then all of a sudden they're like, hey, yeah, everyone, you know, we finished pissing on everything. It's going to be good now. Hey, you remember the Enterprise, right? You remember this? Do you like us now? Is how it felt like to me. So, all right, I guess that's pretty much all our thoughts on Discovery. Terrible series, wasn't worth the effort that was put into it. Season two, who knows what they're going to do. They'd be better off using Discovery as just a name of a series and do like every season in a different era of Star Trek. That's the only way I think they can save it, because I think we're done with this crew.
One final thing I got to say. One of the things that absolutely annoyed me the entire season was the design of the Discovery, like the whole kind of the inverted pizza cutter starship. And I know it's a product of the times and the technology by which we create effects and the sets and all that. But again, this goes back to, this is clearly in the Abramsverse movies, because it just looks way too high-tech.
No, the design of the Discovery is not from an Abramsverse design. It's based off of the failed Star Trek movie that was going to be the motion picture called Planet of the Titans. The Planet of the Titans Enterprise design looks exactly like that. And the Planet of the Titans was a horrible Star Trek movie idea. Basically, the idea is everyone's racing to find the Planet of the Titans, because the Titans were a super highly technological race from long ago that failed and disappeared. The Enterprise somehow falls into a time loop, falls to Earth in prehistoric ages. The captain of the Enterprise and the crew teach the prehistoric man how to use fire and wheels and stuff like that, and then they realize, we are the Titans! And then they travel back to the future.
And also the way it spun when it did the spore drive teleport, why? That's all I'm saying. That is the dumbest transition effect I've ever seen.
It was.
So, I think that we said all we can say. Watch it if you want, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Yep. Well, this is your host, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
Red Ink.
We're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.